Brothers and sisters, we are ready to begin our first class. Our speaker is Brother Jim Stiles. The theme for Brother Stiles' classes this week is Ezra, Working Together in God's Service. Today's class is entitled, Don't Give Up When Things Go Wrong. Brother Jim?
Thanks, Paul. Good morning, everyone. We're almost halfway through. We're getting there. So hopefully everybody's learning something about Ezra. And really the main goal of the studies this week, though, is to realize how important it is to work towards unity in ecclesial life and appreciate it when you have it and do the same thing in our families and trying to find a way to work to be peacemakers in all the things of God's family. And today, especially, don't give up when things go wrong. So remember yesterday we left off with the fact at the end of chapter 3, where they had finally laid the foundation of the temple. And people were already realizing that, it's not as big as the other one was. And it's not full of all the glorious things that the other one was. And some of the people, they shouted and they praised God because the younger ones were excited. They'd never seen the old temple, so they had no comparison for that. And some of the older ones wept and they were disappointed. And as Haggai and Zechariah are going to remind them later on, as part of the motivation to get back to work, this hung on for almost 20 years, this feeling about it's not as good, it's not great, why get involved, it's nothing anyways. And so both prophets have to answer this by coming in as Haggai does. Is it not in your sight is nothing? That's how they saw it. And Zechariah, who has despised the day of small things? And the problem was, brethren and sisters, that the older members focused on the result, not the process. That's the challenge of our day, is to realize as ecclesial leaders, as parents, that we want to, I'm one of those people, I'm so focused on getting from A to B, I want to get to that point right there, and my whole life has been about efficiency getting there, raising 6 kids, and all the different things I was doing in school, it was all about efficiency. And every so often you have to step back in ecclesial life and family life and realize, wait a minute, God's more concerned about how we get there than he is about whether or not we ever get there. He can do that instantly if he wants to. So what then God does is he sends out his angels right here, and you can imagine how the angels had discussions about how are we going to handle this? How are we going to get these people that have come back united at first, and they're already starting to split up. There already is a division amongst them between the older and the younger. How do we get them to realize that unity is important and that we have to work together? And what they do is the angels bring these custom-made trials into our lives. And in this case, that's what they did here. So in Ezra chapter 4, you start to see the challenges begin, the troubles, the problems. So in verse 1, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin, now notice how they're first introduced, the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin. I want to stress that because I've had folks write me before where they've been influenced by online articles, and they think that Ezra and Nehemiah don't even belong in the Bible because when you look at Ezra and Nehemiah, they're so anti-Gentile compared to the New Testament with the Apostle Paul. They figure that these books don't even belong in the Bible. But these Gentiles weren't believers. These were adversaries from the start. When they heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and the heads of the fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do." See, it sounded great. You know, "For we have sacrificed to him since the days of Esarhaddon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, "You may do nothing with us to build a house for our God. But we alone will build to the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." So the leaders took a firm stand. They weren't going to compromise in this case with these folks. And they are adversaries. They were Samaritans who really weren't part of the community. They sort of wanted the benefits of being a part of this bigger group. Sure, come in and join us and we'll help you build and stuff like that. And they were expecting something from this, but they really weren't part of the community. Yeah, the Jews could have sure used the help, right? Yeah, when people want to help you build and want to help in a project, we're glad to have them help. But these leaders were realizing that, hey, this is a spiritual decision. The reason we got carried away into captivity in the first place is because we became too united with the nations around us and their gods. And that's why God had to drive the idols out of our hearts. And they mentioned the days of Esarhaddon, the son of Sennacherib right there. That's like 130 years ago that this happened when the Assyrians came down from the north and they took the northern kingdom and split them up, right? And so it sounded good. We want to worship God too. But it was that other part of it that, well, we also want our idols that they had to take a stand on. It wasn't just an upfront argument of we want to worship your God, because the Jews were accepting people at this time who wanted to worship Yahweh, the God of Israel. They were coming into the community. There's evidence of these people coming in. That's why it talks about how they praise the God of Israel at the end of chapter 2 and now here in chapter 3 and here again in chapter 4. There were some converts being made, but these were genuine converts to some extent, not just people who wanted to take their religion and incorporate Judaism as well. So you remember the Assyrians had moved the Jews out of the north back before. The Assyrian policy was when they conquered nations is that they would go in and they would remove the local people and take them and scatter them all over their empire. And then they would bring in people from all over the empire and put them into Israel, into their conquered areas. And they did that because they figured that way they'll never rebel, because they'll never get along and they'll never be able to come up with some kind of rebellion against the king. It was a great strategy as far as like trying to control a kingdom. So what had happened, though, is that the Gentiles that had come in had intermixed, and they brought in all their pagan gods, and they were worshiping them as well. You remember back in 2 Kings 17, where this is actually covered in our Bibles, and what had happened is that, you know, they realized that when the Samaritans, when all these different peoples were brought together into Israel, there were all kinds of problems that were developing. And so what they did to solve the fact that there was all this going on in the land in verse 28, then one of the priests whom they'd carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear Yahweh. You know, we're going to tell you about our God, right? However, in verse 29, every nation continued to make gods of its own and put them in shrines on the high places. And in verse 30, they worshiped all these different gods. They had Succoth Benoth, and the men of Cuth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avarites, they made Nibhaz and Tartak, and all these different gods that even the Sepharites, they burned their children in the fire to their gods. And so in verse 32, the summary is at the end of 2 Kings, as a result of the Assyrians intermixing and diluting all the peoples in the land up in the north, so they feared Yahweh. Oh yeah, they knew about Yahweh, the God of Israel. And from every class, they appointed for themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the shrines of the high places. And these people really didn't want to convert to the one God of Israel, but they just wanted to join in helping and incorporating them as part, because they heard the shout at the end of chapter 3. They knew the Jews were back in the land. They knew that there was a temple going to be built. They heard there were rumblings of what was going on and what Cyrus had commanded. And they figured, well, better to have them incorporated as part of our group and have them be our enemies. So they came in and tried to join. So, and remember in 2 Kings 17 at the very end, it says there, they feared Yahweh in verse 33. They feared him. They feared him, but yet they served their own gods according to the rituals of the nations from among whom they were carried. And to this day, they continue practicing the former rituals. They do not fear the Lord. And so that's the way it got left. They acted like they wanted to help, but they really didn't. So the first test when they in this situation is, are the Jews that return from the captivity, are they going to return to idolatry? Are they going to go take all these people that want to help and bring them in? And are they going to incorporate all of their way of life that a lot of the Jews would have liked? Yeah, because idol worship really was the primary cause of the 70-year captivity. Remember, we looked in Ezekiel where God finally says, even though you've destroyed all those idols, Josiah, and you've wiped them all out, ground them to powder, and they're all gone, you burn the wooden ones, then I can't get them out of their hearts. They still have idolatry. So are the people going to be willing to separate from the nations, stand firm for Yahweh, their God, and guard the truth that God had entrusted to them? Then the answer is right now, yes. They start out with really good intentions. That is the beginning thing. But what happened over time is it crept in. It just crept in because it's a constant thing that we have to be on guard against. And you'll see by the end of the story of Ezra that already the mixed marriages problem had developed. So Joshua and Zerubbabel, their defense is, all right, to the Samaritans, is they said, look, you know, in verse 3, we're just doing what Cyrus told us to do. This is what Cyrus commanded, that we should go up to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. And so those already in the land, they really weren't involved yet. And the people of the land, what they did in verse 4, they discouraged the Jews. They decided, you know, this compromise thing was going to lead to immediate trouble, and they didn't want to compromise. But what happened is that some of the Jews became discouraged. The older ones who were already upset that this foundation of the temple, it's really not very good, not like we had before. What that leads to in ecclesial life is discouragement, and it just filters down and spreads out amongst the community. That's what negative talk does in ecclesial life. And it does the same thing in families. If mom and dads come home from meeting and all they do is talk about all the negative things in the car about what went on in the ecclesia that day, how in the world are our children ever going to love the truth? How is that going to happen? Unless we talk about positives, we talk about exciting things, and we try to encourage them. We want to keep an upbeat, positive spirit and let our children know that we love this. Well, sure, there's problems, but we'll work through them. We'll do the best we can and pray for God's help along the way. So they started out really good with this decision of we're not going to compromise, because Jews are good at looking back through history and realizing that through their Bibles, this is what they would do. They would look in their military strategies and in their spiritual decisions. They'd look back and say, all right, we don't want to do that, right? Because we remember what happened when that occurred. And you can go back and look at Lot when he made political alliances back in Genesis 19, when he's right there in the gate of Sodom. And as much as he was trying and thought he was going to be helpful, he was losing his entire group that he had originally separated from Abraham because there wasn't room for them, right, in the land. And now we're down to like Lot and what, you know, his wife and a couple of daughters, and that's all he's got left at the time when Sodom is destroyed. Or look at Judah. What a contrast to Joseph back in Genesis 37. Judah comes along in chapter 38, and God forces us to compare the differences between these two. One of them is seeking God, and the other one is just out there seeking the gains of this world. That was Judah. He was a businessman. He was into economic growth. He wanted the things of this life. And he made alliances, him and Hira, right, his best friend. And you even consider Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat's dad had made mistakes. He had gone up and he tried to like war against the northern kingdom, and he had made an alliance with the Syrians over there, and he thought he had solved the problem with the king of the north, with the king up in the northern kingdom at the time. And in the end, it nearly cost him his life. And in the end, it probably did. He had made some mistakes about what he had done about trying to war against the northern kingdom. And so Jehoshaphat comes along, and he just decides his whole life, when you read his record, you wonder, like, how in the world could he keep doing this? But if you had lived through his history, you would understand that he realized his dad messed up. He shouldn't have been fighting against the north like he was. And Jehoshaphat sets out to seek unity at all costs, really, is what he had done. He's a great example of how if your goal is unity and you just don't care how you get there, look at Jehoshaphat and you'll see how he constantly makes mistakes because he didn't understand the process. He was after the goal. Then he makes marriage alliances. He makes political and military alliances up there with Ahab. And in the end, even when he's reamed out for all of those things, he ends up in the end making an alliance that's economic about let's build ships together down there at Ezion Geber, right? And, and that was even after the prophet had said to him, like, how can you love those who don't love the Lord? But he still was committed to unity, and he wanted to constantly unite with the northern kingdom. And so, you know, Jehu finally told him at that point in 2 Chronicles 19, should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. We can't compromise, brethren and sisters, in those areas. We cannot compromise. It's good to be nice to people and work with people, but we can't compromise on the spiritual things that are going to pull our children and our ecclesias into the things of this world and the gods of this world. We've got to draw that line. Look in Hebrews 11 at the people who made tough decisions by faith for their long-term results. These people aren't focused on the immediate. They're not just trying to get through the day. They're looking for the long term about what's best for their families and their ecclesias. And that's what Noah was doing when he built the ark and he suffered for it. Or Abraham, when he was willing to offer up Isaac. He's willing to lose his son at that moment and go through the impossible of what God had asked him to do because he believed beyond hope that God must resurrect him from the dead. He left Ur. Remember when he did that? And he gets to the land and God says, go to this land I'm going to show you. And he gets there. There's a famine in the land. He has to go on down to Egypt. Or remember when he let Lot make the first choice. Abraham trusted God and the decisions he made in his life were based on that. And that's what God's hoping we're going to learn from these character studies is learn to trust him like these characters did. Or Moses, when he demanded Pharaoh let the Jews go, you know, even though Pharaoh made life harder for the Jews, and he goes to God and says, like, you know, this isn't working. All they're doing is now everybody hates me. He has to trust that God is working in this and that in the end, this process they're going through will hopefully change some people's lives. Unfortunately, for that generation of Jews, it didn't. They saw all those things. They saw all those miracles. They watched God day after day try to get them to trust him, and they still kept complaining through their lives. Something goes wrong, and their first reaction is to gripe. You know, why have you brought us out? They remembered the good old days, right? When we had those onions and leeks and all that stuff. Remember those good old days? And they colored the past and with rosy glasses that weren't right at all, but we don't want to be like that. Brothers and sisters, we want to realize that God, through these trials and troubles, he's trying to train us. He's trying to get us to trust him. He's trying to get us to be the people he could invite into his family forever. And if we don't respond to that, we're like that generation that gets cut off in the wilderness. And we don't want to end up like them. Or look at Rahab when she hid the spies, making a long-term decision for her family. Not some short-term thing because she had to face the people when they knocked on the door and she had to trust that God would take care of her. So some of those long-range spiritual decisions, right? They have some immediate uncomfortable results, tough decisions and discussions that we have with their children about decisions that we're making as a family. Or sometimes ecclesias do the same thing. But our goal is the long-term, not the short-term things. And that's what faith does. It drives us to believe that God's in it for the long term. So the people of the land, they tried to discourage them from building. They troubled them, right? They hired counselors in verse 5 against them to frustrate their purpose. All the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia. So this is starting early on, right? Because they're still building for about 6 years of Cyrus's life, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. That's the whole span of what you're going to look at here in chapter 4. It starts with a summary verse that this is what they did. They hired counselors. They frustrated them the entire time, right through the entire building of the first 16 years. 16 years they're working on this and there's people working against them all the way. And then he specifically says in verse 6, in the reign of Ahasuerus. So this would be the next one after Cyrus. In the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So that's the next king who came after Cyrus. I really believe this chapter is in chronological order. And then in verse 7, in the days of Artaxerxes, all right? So here's the next king after Cambyses took over, after Cyrus, his son Cambyses took over. And now you're into the next one. In the days of Artaxerxes, he calls them. Also, Bishlam, Meredith, Tabel, and the rest of their companions wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the letter was written in Aramaic script and translated into the Aramaic language, which is part of why Ezra goes back and forth between this Aramaic and Hebrew, I think. So if you've never looked at this before and you start wondering like who were those kings were, we're going to look at that in this chapter today and hopefully we'll get an understanding of how this works out. But my assumption is that the simplest solution is always the best. And if you follow it through in chronological order, he actually covers all of the kings leading up to the final building of the temple when it was finally finished. So test number two that they run into in verses 4 and 5 right now is, were the people ready to endure tribulation from without? See, that's the next question. It's one thing to like block out, but now the next question is, are you ready for the next step when things start to get bad? It's pretty similar to what happened with the Jews in Egypt, isn't it? That, you know, as soon as they wanted to like be let go, and now we're going to come down, and Pharaoh says, all right, well, you go gather your own straw, right? And then they got start getting picked on. So that's a different problem. So were they ready to endure the trouble for many years and continue steadfast in the ecclesial building project? Are they going to devote themselves to God when things get rough, when economic times get bad, or when pressures are on them from the outside? That's the challenge of today. Are we willing to continue even when things go wrong? Sort of like Joseph going through all his life, he starts out a spiritual man, and every step along the way, it seems like things get worse and worse and worse for all of his spiritual development. And we have to trust that God is in it. He's trying to train us. I really believe our problem is we don't understand really. We talk about it, but do we really understand how bad we are and how tough the training program is to get us to where God wants us to be? If we all believe that really, we would never say to God, that's not fair. We'd all understand right away that this is what it takes to save me. I'm that bad. I'm that far away from God that I need to go through these things. It's not a question of whether it's fair. The fair part is, was it fair for God to spend all this time trying to change me? That's what we should be asking. Why did he try to change me instead of somebody else out there? That other person got left out of God's election, and you have been invited. You're part of the family of God. He's trying to train, and what a great opportunity it is. So for this one, the problem was, no, they weren't ready to endure the pressures, the longer range trouble that they ran into. They started out enthusiastic. They started out in the building project. And as the years go on and the adversaries are putting pressure on them, there is mounting talk amongst the Jewish community. Why are we bothering with this? All this stuff about building the temple is just causing trouble. And the work that originally started with such enthusiasm that they were shouting for joy, over time, it just waned and waned. And you can imagine what it's like. It's sort of like breakfast in the morning, Dana, when you realize that as the days go on, right, there's going to be fewer and fewer people there. And in the end, he said by tomorrow morning, he'll be talking to himself. And That's about what happened. You know, people showed up for the building project, and you can imagine how every day as time went on, fewer and fewer people came to help. And what did they do instead? They stayed home. They built their own houses, right? They planted their crops and took care of their own land. They took care of all their stuff back home, and they improved their economic situation. At least they thought they would. And Haggai has to come along and say to them, well, really, you know, consider your ways, that phrase that it uses, is some of the versions actually say, consider how you fared. Look back over a few years, and are things really going better? Are you really better economically off than you were before? You paneled your houses and you got all that, but are you really better off? And that's what Haggai is going to do, because they were failing at this point. They hadn't met the test. So the pressure's on. So where in the world are we in this period? So if you look at the kings that reigned at this time, here's what we've got. We're up here with Cyrus right there. Good, that works. We got Cyrus up in here, and they're building the temple for about 6 years during his reign. And then there is his son Cambyses, who takes over after him for about 8 years. And then what God did is, you know, that's when you look at how the angels are involved in our world today, and you imagine what they're doing politically in our worlds amongst the nations. What God did right there, according to the historians, is he had Cambyses killed by somebody who wanted to take over the kingdom. There's a coup. And the fellow who took over claimed to be the brother of Cambyses. That's his claim. They call him Gomates sometimes in history. A lot of people call him Pseudo-Smertus because he was also known by the name of Smertus, I guess, which another name that he had up there. But they call him Pseudo-Smertus because he was a fake. So this fella comes in and he takes over the kingdom right there after a coup. And he's only there for a short period of time. But during that period of time, he knew that his kingdom was like really risky at this point, and he couldn't afford to have any trouble in the kingdom. And as soon as that letter comes to him about these Jews are rebelling from your kingdom, they're going to build up their city and they're going to cause you all kind of trouble, he immediately sends the army down and makes them stop. So these are the kings that we're talking about here in Ezra chapter 4. It's these three fellas. It starts out with Cyrus, then Cambyses, then this Gomedes, and finally it ends up with Darius Hystaspes, where the temple's actually finished. That's finally in the reign of Darius when they finally get back to work. So some Christadelphians, just so you are aware, if you ever do studies on this time period of Ezra and Nehemiah and you're reading books by Christadelphians, you're wondering, like, what's going on here? The brethren from England sort of unanimously all take the Darius to be who finally gets the king, when Ezra returns, they take it to be this fellow back here, Artaxerxes Longimanus. That's who they think the Artaxerxes is actually in Ezra chapter 4. The problem with that is, it doesn't make any sense to be talking about this guy down here where the temple's actually finished. We know that in the sixth year of Darius right here, the temple's finished. So why would Ezra chapter 4 be talking about some guy who comes along 60 years later? But that's their understanding, because they're worried about these names of Artaxerxes and Ahasuerus. They get hung up on the names. But these names are just kings. They're just like titles for a king. And they're actually known, in the world at least, you could be called by different names, just like we do with prime minister and president and king and different names that we have today. So I've never really liked that idea of going with this. If you're reading any of the Australian works, just to show you how cultures differ in our community, the Australian brethren have all bought into Brother H.P. Mansfield's idea, which he actually borrowed from others, if you look in Bullinger and different things, that really we're all talking about right here, this whole region from Cyrus to Darius Hystaspes, and that the king that we're talking about in Ezra is this Artaxerxes fella, is actually this Darius Hystaspes when Ezra returns. And we don't even deal with all of this later on back here because it's way too far in the future. Ezra chapter 4 is just about the kings for the building of the temple. That's all it's talking about. So Darius Hystaspes, he comes by. If you go with him, it works out fine chronologically. But if you go with Artaxerxes Longimanus back here, you're looking at about 58 years later, according to the Persian records, when he would have come along. And then they think that Nehemiah took place back in here as well. But the problem with it is that verse 24 clearly shows in this chapter that this is all about the temple. It's not about building the walls. So you can't just go to outside commentaries and read them and follow through, because our brother in England, that's what they've done. They've just gone with the standard view of what commentaries would take, speaker's commentary that they follow. And they've gone with that view of thinking that was Artaxerxes Longimanus. But if Ezra had come back, if Ezra did return in the sixth year of this king back here in Artaxerxes Longimanus, he would have been really, really, really old. And you have to come up with a reason for why did he wait 60 years after the temple was finished to come back. Ezra, it's like the way it reads in the record is that as soon as the temple's finished, Ezra gathers a bunch of people and says, let's go. We're ready to go. He's an older fella, all right, but he's waiting for the temple to be finished. So in this case, in Ezra chapter 4, the fellow that's called Ahasuerus is actually Cambyses, who's the son of Cyrus. And Artaxerxes in this chapter is actually this fellow right here who's the fake king, the guy who took over and ran the coup and is an imposter. He's called Artaxerxes in this chapter. So when you look down at Ezra chapter 4 at verse 23, you can see that the summary verse of the chapter makes it very clear that we should be reading this chapter chronologically. Because it says when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read, this is the letter that this chapter is about. When the copy of this letter is read, all right, before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms made them cease. So by the end of chapter 4 of Ezra, we've run through this scope now of these kings to where now this imposter's taken over, and he hears this letter, and he gets spooked out, and right away he sends out the army and says, make them stop. And thus the work on the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. So this Darius right here, the king of Persia, would be this fellow right here, Darius Hystaspes. And you can see what happened, that Ezra 4 is really just about this little period right in here from Cyrus to Darius, and tells you how the adversaries caused trouble. So that's the key, that the temple work stopped in the reign of Artaxerxes. And we know that when it stopped was in the reign of the king before Darius Hystaspes. And history then points out this guy was an imposter. And we also know that, in reading the next chapter, that the temple gets finished very clearly in the sixth year of the reign of Darius. So it starts up again in the second year, and it finishes in the sixth year. So all you're dealing with right here in Ezra 4 is this little period here, and it's describing how the initial excitement and the work that was all going on, it started to slow down and slow down and slow down because of all the adversaries causing trouble during the reign of Cambyses and finally into Gomedes, and it stopped. And it stopped only... Some of us, don't realize when you're reading the record, it didn't stop for that long. It only stopped for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and that was it. And then the people got going again, because by the second year of Darius, that's when Zechariah and Haggai are doing their work, and the people got back to work. So it was a momentary stop, but God forced the people to consider their ways. What do you really want? So this Artaxerxes in verse 7 of the chapter that we're in right there, as you flow through this chapter, this fellow right here in verse 7 is the same fellow right here, because they're writing the letter to him. It must be this guy who only came in for about 6 months or so, the imposter fellow, and that's the one who caused the work to stop. But it was building pressure on the Jewish people as all this is going on. So if you ever look in the history of the Persian kings, Cyrus is the one who made the decree right there. His son Cambyses is the one who then reigns next, who our Bible referred to there as Ahasuerus. And then this fella takes over. Sometimes in history, they think he was this fella right here who was the brother right there, this guy named Bardiah. Other people call him Gomedes. Even all these names show you how he was doing his best to take over the kingdom, but it just wasn't working. And in the end, the folks got together in Persia, the leaders did, and they all just said, hey, somebody's got to take him out. And they did, and they agreed to let Darius become the next king. But what that did is it switched over in the family lines right here of the Persian kings right there. That was the end of Cyrus's line. And then it went over to Darius, and then finally from him to Xerxes, and then Artaxerxes, the other fellow, Longimanus. So if those of you that are history buffs, that's actually what's going on. So we're only going to deal with, in Ezra 4, this period right here from Cyrus to Darius Hystaspes. That's all this really is. And if you look at how this works, you can see that the temple started back here in Ezra's time. It continued right through until it finally stopped right here in the, when you're looking at Gomedes right here, it stops back here. They start building again right here, and it's finished by the time that the sixth year of Darius. And in the seventh year, Ezra returns. Makes sense, right? The next year, he comes back. That made a lot more sense to me. So for those of you that like charts and stuff, there you go. There's a chart of all the kings, the name that they have in Ezra chapter 4, their historical name, and how long they actually reigned. And in God's wonderful way of controlling the world, it turned out there was exactly 20 years from the beginning of the building of the temple until the time that it was finally ended, which fulfilled the two prophecies of Jeremiah that were 20 years apart. So they write this letter, right, in Ezra chapter 4, right, against Jerusalem. And you can read through this letter yourself. You can see what it is. But they piled up all their reasons as to why the Jews should stop. And this king, who's the imposter, he hears all this stuff and he just figures, okay, we can't continue this. We've got to get it out. We got to get it stopped. And when you look at the lies that they built into this letter, look at how they said things like in verse 12, right? They're rebuilding the rebellious and evil city and finishing its walls and repairing the foundations, even though all they were really working on was the temple. That's all that they were doing. And then they claim in verse 13, look at the false accusations. They won't pay the taxes, the tribute, or the custom, and the king's treasury will be diminished, right? And if you're looking for reasons to slow down the work, right, this is it, isn't it? Economics, right? You're not going to get all that money you were hoping for. And they're piling up all these reasons as to why they should stop the work. And of course, well, it's not proper for us to see the king's dishonor. They're appealing to his pride and all these great things. These people knew what they were doing. They're using all the strategies of the flesh to appeal to this fella to make a decision. And if you search in the records, go back and you'll look, you'll see that Jerusalem is a rebellious city, right? You go back and look, and you could find times where they rebelled. That's in the end. Look with Zedekiah. That's why in the end, the king of Babylon came down again and Nebuchadnezzar surrounded the city because Zedekiah rebelled. Even though in Ezekiel, we find out that he was made to make a covenant with Yahweh that he would not rebel. Like the king of Babylon did that. He made him make a covenant with Yahweh, probably by Daniel's influence. You know, get him to swear by Yahweh. He won't rebel, but he still did anyways. So look at all these troubles. They pile up all the reasons why they shouldn't follow this imposter, and they shouldn't follow the, and allow the king to, allow them to rebuild the city. And they pressured this imposter king. And that's basically how the work stopped. So what they did in the end, you know, they stopped the work. But what we have to do, brethren and sisters, is realize in work life, in ecclesial life, there are going to be times where sides develop. And unfortunately, what people do when there's sides on an issue is they pile up all the greatest evidence that they can find against the other side and exaggerate it. I mean, you see that happen. This is what Gentiles do. This is what unbelievers do because they don't believe God is in control. They think they're in control. We got to make this happen. And God's warning us. We don't want to be like these people. We don't want to be like that. Don't want to exaggerate things. We don't want to present things in the worst light. We want to be honest and open and lay all the things out on the table and try to make good decisions, but not emphasizing and exaggerating things about other brethren and sisters and their families, their children, other ecclesias and making them in the worst light or whatever. We have to be working in honesty towards unity. That's the goal and believe that God is in it. God will take care of these things. He's the one who's in control. It's not my family and my ecclesia. It's God's, and he'll take care of it if I just behave the right way. That's the hard part for us. And they look at all these lies that they piled up. Sometimes we have to put up with that. There are going to be people that lie about us in life. You're going to see it happen either, you know, out in the workforce, your neighborhood, the ecclesia, somewhere. It's going to happen to you. And the question is, how do you respond? See, God's interested in the process. He's letting these things happen so that he can train us. He wants to find out, what are we going to do? Are we going to yell at somebody? You know, what are we going to do with our spouses if you think they're lying about you or they're saying things about you that aren't right? Have they got your motives wrong? What am I supposed to do? Go to Sue and yell and scream at her and let everybody watch that? I mean, that's no way to handle these things. God's putting us into these situations to test us, to develop us, to develop the character of Jesus Christ. That's what he did. When people lied about him, he didn't throw out threats. When he suffered, he didn't threaten, Peter says. Why? Because he trusted to him who judges justly. And by his stripes, we are healed. That's how it works. That's the training program. Jesus bought into it entirely. And all of us were sort of buying into it. But when things go bad, we don't like the training program. But that's the only way for God to get us to the end result. He cares about that process. So you put up with those lies. So the king finally sends an answer, right? And he finds out, oh yeah, this city did rebel at times. It did do all these things that you're saying about, at least some of them at least, of what they were saying about. And so in verse 21, he gives the command to make the men cease, that the city may not be built until the command is given by me. Now, can't you see how this worked out politically? I love to look at how the angels were controlling these things. In a moment of time, it went from Cambyses being king to where an imposter takes over. He's scared stiff about losing control of the kingdom, and he's making these decisions based on fear, and he's just like, anybody like this writes a letter, they're going to rebel, shut him down, make it stop, make it go away, and bring peace to the kingdom because he's afraid. But that's how fast the angels can bring changes into our lives. This is what they do. I mean, you look at like David's situation. You know, you read about in Samuel. He wants to go up and help Achish, right? And he gets his guys up there. He leaves Ziklag alone, right? And then war goes on with the Philistines and Israel's destroyed. Saul's killed. Jonathan's killed. David comes back to Ziklag. They want to stone him because everybody's gone. The Amalekites came through and took him. And 1 week later, he's king. This is what angels do. They overturn things in a moment. Because they change things so fast when they want to. And they install that man as king. And these men wanted to stone him. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God, the record says. He got the men to rally. He prayed about it. They went and got all the people the Amalekites had taken. They come back. Ziklag's gone. Why did God get rid of Ziklag? Because he wanted David to realize you're going to have to move in. Go back to Israel. And see, if you trust that the angels are controlling those events of your life, you don't fight them anymore. You just look at, well, what am I learning from this? What direction does God want me to go, our family to go, or our ecclesia to go? And we trust that he's in control. He's the one who's guiding and directing us. We pray for it a lot, but sometimes we don't know how to respond to it when it's actually happening right in front of us. So the work stopped, right? By force and by power, the army comes in, they make them stop. And the warning to all of us, brethren and sisters, is when we gripe and when we complain, like Israel did coming out of Egypt, and we look at the negatives about our family, about our ecclesia, eventually enough stuff piles up where God says, well, if you don't like this, I'll take it all away. Take it away. Can't do it anymore. And we don't want to get to that point where the training program involves taking everything away. He can take our health. He can take our family. He can take our ecclesia, and it can all just disintegrate in a moment. And then we look at each other and say, wow, that's not really what we wanted. But sometimes the angels have to do that to get us to realize that we've got to be more positive and thankful, appreciative of what God has given us, to appreciate his grace and his mercy and realize I don't deserve what I even have. There's no way you could earn it. It's all by the grace of God. So the work stopped only for about 2 years, right? I'm sure the true believers were probably really frustrated. They had to quit, but it was a time to challenge the community. You know, do you really want this or not? And sometimes God has to take it away, but faith is what gets all of us through. So you look at, well, why did the work stop? Well, for 15 years, they've been working about 15 years right now, and it had worn them out. The adversaries had worn them out, right? The older people, they didn't like it in the first place. You see how that eats away at you when you have that spirit of negativism? It just starts to grow over time. And when other things go bad, the negative stuff starts to build and build. And you can imagine the people saying, yeah, see, they were all right at the first time when we were laying the foundation. The older folks, they all knew what was right. They knew this was no good. We should have quit back then. You can imagine those discussions going on in ecclesial life back then. And, you know, it's just a warning that this is human nature. This is what we're like. And then the adversaries, they hired counselors against them. And the workers, honestly, you know, when you go home next week, what are we going to go home and do and think about first? Are we going to like worry about our economic situation, our houses, all the stuff, the toys and everything we can get? Or are we going to go home and decide what can we do better to help out in God's family? What can we do? What can we do with money that we have? We going to redo our house? We going to rebuild things, buy a new car? Or are we going to look at ways to help out in the mission field, help those brethren and sisters in Africa and Turkey that are just going through terrible times? God's challenging us, brothers and sisters. Where is our faith? What do we really want out of this life? It's Ecclesiastes all over again. And the people were afraid. They were afraid of the adversaries. So all that was building up on them. And it was a time for faithful believers to step forward and say, we can do this with God's help. God will help us get it done. And that's what happens. He sends them Zechariah and Haggai to stir up the people, to get them motivated again. And just in an instant of time, he wipes out the imposter king and he sets up Darius Hystaspes, who looks back and finds out, oh yeah, let's get this done. And God was able to do far more than they could even imagine, ask or think, as Paul says. So for this class, let's remember there are some times that we need to draw a line and refuse to participate and allow others to participate in things of our ecclesias. That's what we have to do. He's expecting us to make that distinction, as Brother Dave reminded us in the exhortation last week. All those rules that are in Leviticus and all that was to try to raise our minds to think about making distinctions and choosing the good and resisting the evil. We have to do that. And drawing a line, brethren and sisters, may lead to trouble. It might. That might be what happens at first when we make a decision and we draw a line. And it happens in our families and ecclesias. But it's the right thing to do, to draw those lines and make good spiritual decisions. Because God is just testing us at that point to see if it's really what we want. And endurance through tribulation is a tough test. It is tough. But the angel's job right now is to run us through those tests to find out if they can develop us into God's children. That is their job. And what are you hoping to do in the kingdom? What are you hoping to do when Christ says that you will be made equal to the angels? And there's all these mortal people on the kingdom, in the kingdom age. Right now, we're supposed to be learning how to do this with our children, with our spouses, with our families, with our ecclesias. We are in training right now to recognize God's training program. How did he do it for me? So that we can do it for others in the kingdom age. That's what we're training for. And sometimes we focus on the idea that, oh, the kingdom will be wonderful. And we look at it from our perspective of, oh, it's going to be peace and joy and all my problems are going to be gone. Look, we're going to be active in the kingdom like the angels are today. We're training to become workers in God's family. It's not just sit back and enjoy and lay back with no problems anymore and life is wonderful. There's going to be challenges when we act as angels. Angels are challenged all the time. Imagine how they go through frustrations discussing with one another. I tried this with Jim and I tried this and nothing's working. Anybody got any more ideas? And this is what they go through. Imagine if you were the angel who had worked with Lot's wife all your life, you know, well, all her life, and you'd work with her and work with her, and she's coming out of Sodom, and you're hoping she won't look back. Don't look back. And she turns around and looks back. There's frustrations to this. This is not just a life of just sit back and enjoy peace and quiet, but the people we work with, oh, that's the joy. The angels, the saints of this age that are joined with them, it will be fun. It will be a lot of fun to work with people whose goal is to accomplish the will of God. No jealousy, no envy, no other agendas involved. It will be great. So the warning today that comes out of this chapter also is that God may give us what we really want. Be careful what you're praying for. You know, if our goal in life really is to just get a bunch of toys and we want to go home and prove our economic situation and we want all these things of this world, God may give them to us. He might, but we may be losing out on our spiritual life. We've got to be careful that we don't just look negatively at the things of the truth. Turn them into positives. Look at the joys of being here at Bible school this week. People come here and they're all excited. They love this, right? Well, go home and keep that spirit. It doesn't have to be just with brethren and sisters. It can be all these other people. It could be your neighbors. It could be people you work with. Take it home with you and practice it in every aspect of your life because God's going to give us what we really want. So let's make sure we go home and seek first the kingdom of God, and all these other things will be added to you as well.